Let me just confirm that we'll be having the class presentations on April 21st, and I've received some of your abstracts, but not all of them, so please send me your abstracts as soon as possible, and what I'll do is to compile them all together, and I'll send you a program by email before the day. I'm not sure yet how early in the morning we'll get started, but I'll try to plan out the whole day and let you know about when we're going to be starting. You're going to be teaching starting on that day, is that right? Or before starting before that?
What day of the week is
That's
that?
Monday.
That's a Monday.
Well, that's what I have to decide about. So you're teaching between 11 and 1,
yeah,
right? So maybe I'll try to leave that gap open so that there's no direct conflict. Okay, so what I want to do today is to tell you a little bit about her black hole, but then what I really want to do is to go into those more general properties of black holes, the ones that I said did not require a detailed knowledge of the metric. So what I want to do is to tell you a little bit about her so that we can sort of identify some of those more general properties and recognize them when they're discussed at the more general level. So well, last time we talked about the Schwarzschild metric, we talked about the Reissner-Nordström metric. We had a lot of fun talking about black hole tunnels and things like that, and then thinking about instabilities inside the black hole and the fact that those black hole tunnels in fact do not exist in real physical space-time. So those issues are also present in the Kerr solution. I won't say as much here, but the Kerr interior has some interesting properties, most of which are completely irrelevant because of this instability that you talked about. It's exactly the same instability for Kerr as we discussed for Reissner-Nordström. So a lot of the internal properties of the Kerr black hole based on the extended Kerr solution are mostly fictitious and an artifact of the specialness of the Kerr solution. So let me get started by writing down the metric, the Kerr metric. So here I have to be careful because it's a little bit longer than the other metrics. So let me do it. So we have r squared minus 2mr plus a squared cosine squared theta over a quantity that I'll define in a moment called rho squared. That's the gtt component of the metric. There's a gt phi component to the metric, which is as follows. And there's a phi phi component to the metric, and that involves a quantity sigma that I'll define in a moment over rho squared sine squared theta d phi squared. And then there's a rr component, rho squared over another quantity that I'll define in a moment, delta. And finally, there's a g theta component to the metric. So we have a bunch of quantities here. Rho squared is r squared plus a squared cosine theta squared. Delta is r squared minus 2m over r plus a squared. And sigma is r squared plus a squared all squared minus a squared delta sine squared theta. So it's a little bit longer than the metrics we've talked about, a little bit more complicated. This metric has the property of depending on theta. So this is not a metric which is spherically symmetric, but this is a metric that doesn't depend on time. Excuse me, doesn't depend on time, and it also doesn't depend on phi. So what this metric has is the property of being stationary, t independent, and axis symmetric, phi independent. And to that we have the existence associated with that fact. We have the associated we have Killing vectors which describe the stationarity of the space-time and the axis symmetry of the space-time. So those are Killing vectors.
And the space-time is not spherically symmetric, but it is, you know, stationary and axially symmetric. The metric is a little bit more complicated than Schwarzschild, Oreiser, and Nordstrom, but nevertheless, this is the metric that describes all stationary black holes. So it's pretty remarkable that we can describe all stationary black holes with a metric that takes barely two lines to write down, except for the notation that also needs to be specified. So nevertheless, so in spite of the fact that it's a bit more complicated than the other metrics that we've seen, it's still remarkably simple to describe something which is so interesting as a black hole. This is an exact solution to the Einstein field equations. It was derived by Kerr in the early 60s, and somewhat later it was shown to actually describe a black hole. That's not something that Kerr knew about. The fact that the metric describes a black hole is something that was discovered later by people such as Brandon Carter, who started to look at, you know, the behavior of geodesics and started to also you know, try to come up with an understanding of the quartz singularities that the metric possesses. And you can see that there are, you know, two potential sources of trouble in the metric. When rho goes to zero, which can happen when r squared plus a squared cosine squared theta goes to zero, well, there's something singular funny going on with the metric. And another source of trouble has to do with when delta goes to zero, then so that's a different location. This is what happens when, you know, r squared minus 2m, 2mr plus a squared goes to zero. Those are two potential places where we might have either a real genuine singularity or a quartz singularity. And as it turns out, when you investigate the nature of the space-time and you construct, for example, invariants such as the square of the Riemann tensor, what you discover is that rho equals zero is actually a real space-time singularity. So we have real singularity, a curvature singularity, at rho squared equals zero. But the singularity corresponding to delta equals zero when GRR seems to go to zero, to infinity, that's a coordinate singularity along the same lines that we've encountered before for Schwarzschild and Reissner Nordstrom. So we have a coordinate singularity of the usual type at delta goes to zero. Delta goes to zero gives you a quadratic equation for R, which means that we have two solutions. And those two solutions, well, are, you know, it's like what we had for Reissner Nordstrom. We had an outer horizon and an inner horizon. So this, solving this quadratic equation gives us that R must be equal to R plus or minus, which are defined to be M minus or plus M squared minus A squared, divided by two or not. No, that's it. So two solutions, but two solutions only if M squared is larger than A squared. So here, so I haven't told you what A is. M is the mass of the black hole. A is related to the angular momentum. So by this relationship right here, so A is angular momentum per unit mass. This is something that you learn by either computing the Hamiltonian quantities for this metric or evaluating the Komar integrals, you know, something that I reviewed a while back involving the integral over two sphere of the gradient and the two Killing vectors. So you can actually compute the actual mass of the space-time for the metric and conclude that the that M is the ADM mass of the space-time. You can compute the angular momentum of the space-time and verify that A is really the angular momentum per unit mass. And what we have is the notion that, well, a curved black hole can only rotate so fast. There's a bound on its angular momentum parameter. If the bound if the angular momentum of the object exceeds that bound, that we're not dealing with a black hole, we're dealing with something else, which happens to be a naked singularity. So that's analogous to the charged black hole, where there was a bound on the charge. And if we exceeded that bound, then we didn't have black hole. We had a naked singularity with charge on it. Here we would have a naked singularity with a lot of angular momentum on it. One feature that the Kerr solution has that none of the solutions we've looked at so far had is the fact that there's a non-diagonal component to the metric that corresponds to a rotational effect. So one property that this metric has, which is very important, is the fact that it produces a dragging of inertial frames. So the physical importance, the physical manifestation of this non-diagonal term, which depends on the angular momentum parameter, is that if you release an observer, if you let an observer fall in with zero angular momentum from infinity, that observer will have conserved zero angular momentum. You know, the angular momentum parameter would be the angular momentum would be defined as the inner product between the observer's forward velocity and the killing vector. If the observer is geodesic, if the observer is free falling, that this is a conserved quantity. So if the angular momentum is zero to begin with, it will continue to be zero throughout the motion of the observer. But what will happen, nevertheless, is that the observer will acquire an angular velocity in spite of the vanishing of the angular momentum. So a zero angular momentum observer falling into the space-time will acquire an angular velocity, and physically that has to do with the fact that the black hole is rotating, dragging space-time along with it, and the observer has no choice but to follow along with that rotation, and the effect is created entirely by that term over here. So that's a well-known effect called the dragging of inertial frames, and that is something that is always present when you have space-time that possesses angular momentum. The whole space-time is rotating, and observers falling in will be sort of coerced to rotate along with the space-time, rotate along with the black hole. You have, if you want to resist that that angular motion, that rotational motion, and can't if you choose, you have to either give yourself some angular momentum to compensate for the dragging of inertial frames, or you just correct for the motion by applying the rocket, which means that you don't move along the geodesic, and that means that you have the possibility then of resisting the dragging of inertial frames by maintaining yourself in place, at least killing off your motion along the fly direction. So here I was talking about motion along the fly direction. So that's a rather interesting effect, and it turns out to have real interesting and rather dramatic consequences when you push things to the extreme and go very close to where the black hole is. And as I'm going to discuss in a few minutes, I was talking about trying to apply a rocket to resist the rotational motion of the black hole. Well, this is something that you can do if you're at a safe distance, but as you get closer in, you find that you lose the ability to do that. And in fact, for observers that are really close to the black hole, there's really no choice. They have to rotate along with the black hole. They cannot resist this dragging of inertial frames. So, rather interesting effect, and this is something that we get by including rotation into our black hole solution. So before I go into this, I just want to point out also that, in the same way that the Schwarzschild black hole was shown to be unique in the sense that the Schwarzschild black hole must be the result of gravitational collapse if there's no rotation present. So the statement of the uniqueness theorem is that if you have a black hole space-time, namely you have smooth event horizon, if that black hole is static, that means time-dependent and no rotation, then it must be a Schwarzschild black hole, then space-time must be spherically symmetric, and then you must have a Schwarzschild black hole. Here we have a very similar statement that was proved first by Brent Carter. And the statement is that if you have a stationary black hole, here you allow for rotation. If you have a smooth event horizon, then the black hole must be a curved black hole. It must be, and if you're in vacuum, so there's another clause in the statement of each. uniqueness theorem, the vacuum, the region outside the black hole is a pure vacuum. So if you have, you know, a stationary space-time, which is time-independent but axisymmetric, that's right. If you have a stationary space-time and you allow for rotation, if you have a smooth event horizon, and if you have a vacuum exterior, then the solution has to be the curved solution. The black hole must be a curved black hole. That's the statement of the uniqueness theorem. So all, you know, rotating collapses that that form a black hole will resolve into a curved black hole with only two specifiable parameters, the mass and the angular momentum parameter. Whatever else used to characterize the shape and the structure of the progenitor is washed away in the gravitational collapse, and the only two parameters that survive you know, in black hole description are mass and angular momentum. So that's the essentially the statement of the no-hair theorem. Black holes are exceedingly simple, and they're not simple because we idealize them. They're simple because they are a physical process. They become simple after gravitational collapse. That's a, you know, very remarkable statement that Chandrasekhar has expressed very beautifully in many of his writings, and I have quote in my book, you know, about the beauty of black holes and the fact that all macroscopic black holes are identical to each other except for, you know, different values for the mass and angular momentum. Okay, so let me say a few more things, and I'll you know, tell you a little bit more about the nature of that surface delta equals zero, because what we would like to understand here is where the event horizon actually is. And so let me get started with that. So just before, I was talking about the possibility of maintaining yourself in a state of no rotation. So suppose that we're talking about observers, I'll call them static observers. And those are just observers that would be staying put in space-time. So they move, of course, in the time direction, but they are such that, you know, they are at a constant place spatially in the curve metric. So they have, you know, they don't move in the radial direction, they don't move in the theta direction, and they also do not move in the phi direction. So those are static observers. They just don't move in the space-time except for the time direction. If I have an observer like this, then it's pretty clear that they're following orbits of the time-like Killing vector, because the time-like Killing vector is the one that moves only in the time direction. And I'm saying that my observer will move also only in the time direction. So it must be that the four velocity of the observer and the time by Killing vector point in the same direction. They only differ by a normalization factor. And here I care to, you know, to specify the normalization factor. Well, it's pretty clear that we can have a situation like this, provided that the time by Killing vector is really a time by Killing vector, as opposed to being space-like, as opposed to being null. And when we look at the norm of the Killing vector, we are looking at the time-time component of the metric, and from the expression you have there, well, you see that, well, it's not guaranteed that GTT will always be positive. In fact, well, you're well aware of the fact that when you're dealing with black hole space times, GTT can change sign. And you see that, in fact, well, you know, you have a quadratic equation for R when you set GTT equals zero, and therefore there's going to be two places where GTT is susceptible to change sign. So this changes sign. And the first place it does that is when we have a solution to that quadratic equation. And let's see, I think I know how to solve quadratic equations, but I'll just write down the solution by looking at my notes. So what we find is that there's a place where GTT changes sign, which is a place where T becomes a null vector. What used to be a time by Killing vector is now becoming null at that coordinate position. So, while this is something that we've seen before, we're not terribly surprised about this. The question I want to ask is whether this is the place where the event horizon is, because that's the situation we used to have in Schwarzschild and Rice and Nordstrom when the timeline cubic vector became null. That was, you know, a sign that, you know, that the event horizon was forming, or, you know, this was the place where the event horizon was. And here we have the right sort of thing, because, well, it seems that we have the right sort of thing, because we have the killing vector becoming null. And if it's null, then, you know, it has a chance of being, you know, tangent or normal to a null hypothesis. But the question we really need to ask before we conclude that, and it would turn out to be the wrong conclusion, is that, well, here, yes, we have null vector, but if we ask, is it hypersurface orthogonal? And there are some criteria that we reviewed a long time ago about deciding whether a vector is hypersurface orthogonal or not. And the answer here is no. We have a null vector which is not hypersurface orthogonal, and therefore this vector could not be normal nor tangent, which is the same thing, to an event horizon. That vector could not be tangent to the null generators of an event horizon, because for that to be true, this vector would have to be hypersurface orthogonal, and it is not. So this is not the location of the event horizon. And in fact, that place is still an interesting place in the spacetime. It's the place within which you could not overcome the rotation of the black hole. This is a place where you cannot maintain yourself as a static observer in the spacetime. And the physical meaning of this is that, well, we're trying very hard all the while to maintain your static state and to fight the rotation, the drag of the inertial frames that's exerted by the black hole. This is, you know, you can do it down to that radius, but no longer after that. As soon as you go to an R which is smaller than this in space-time, you cannot fight the drag of the inertial frames. You cannot maintain your static state. You have to start rotating along with the black hole moving in a phi direction. So that place is called the static limit. No static observers exist within the radius given by that. This is not an event horizon. This is a static limit, and I just said it. So no static observers can exist within what is called the static limit. So we're not dealing with an event horizon, but we're dealing with an interesting place whereby, within which observers are forced to rotate off with the black hole. There's really no other choice. So observers within the static limit and that region within the static limit is called the ergosphere of the black hole are forced to rotate. They cannot escape the dragging of inertial frames. But we're not dealing with the event horizons. But with the event horizon, to find the event horizon, we have to allow for rotation. We have to look at observers that will be rotating along with the black. So let me talk about a different class of observers, those that are not static, but rotating with uniform angular velocity around the black hole. Those are called stationary observers. So stationary observers are still moving with R equal constant, theta equal constant, but they're moving in time and they're moving along the phi direction. But they're moving along the phi direction with uniform angular velocity. And the fact that they're rotating along with uniform angular velocity, along with the fact that the curve metric is, stationary and axisymmetric, means that those observers don't perceive any time changes in the gravitational field. They move around, but they're at constant radius, and the phi motion is uniform, therefore you don't see any changes in the local, you know, behavior of the gravitational field, you know, curvature or whatever type of forces, and that's why they're called stationary observers. And stationary distinguishes from static. Static means you don't move at all. Here, you move in a way that's still compatible with the stationary property of the metric, that is, you allow for phi motion with uniform angular velocity. Well, those observers will have four velocity that's going to be not entirely directed along the time direction. There's going to be a component of the velocity vector along the other kinetic vector, along the phi vector. So this is the direction, you know, this is the ut component of the four velocity. This is the u phi component of the four velocity. And the ratio is what defines the angular velocity of the observer. And here we can sort of follow the same sort of reasoning. This is something, so you can have stationary observers so long as this vector here on the right-hand side is time-like. And now I want to ask, well, you know, what are the conditions for that to be true? When is this time-like? This must be time-like. And there's an equation that I can write down, which gives me this, you know, this condition, which gives me this, you know. So if I want a time-like vector on the right-hand side, it has to be true that the norm of that vector is smaller than zero. And the way to look at this is to recognize that this will give me a quadratic equation for omega. So this is a quadratic equation for omega, which means that I'll get a solution if omega is bounded between two limiting values. And so this is a quadratic in omega. And what I get from this when I did work, and you could, you know, read a little bit more about that in the book, but what you find is that, well, we will satisfy this condition provided that the angular velocity of the observer is bounded between a minimum value and a maximum value. And of course, we know that at the static limit, this is going to be zero. The angular velocity of the observer has to be larger than zero as it goes beneath the static limit. So what I want to figure out is, well, what happens when you go, you know, closer and closer to the black hole, when you let R go, you know, smaller than the static limit. So we know that we cannot contain static observers within the static limit. I want to ask, you know, how much longer, how much, you know, for smaller, how, you know, can we maintain stationary observers as we get closer into the black hole? And the idea, well, again, it follows from the detailed work, but as R decreases from the static limit, what we find is that those limiting values here become closer together, get closer together. This increases, and omega plus decreases, and there comes a point where the bound, where the allowed window for omega becomes very, very narrow, and there comes a point where, in fact, the window collapses to one unique possible value. And that happens, again, you have to do the detailed work to see this, when R approaches R plus, which was defined before, what you find is that those two limiting values become equal. And that, you know, is a value that I'll call omega h, which physically will represent the, you know, angular velocity of the black hole as a whole. At that point, and here essentially we've reached the event horizon, at that point all observers must rotate with one unique speed, which, you know, has to be associated, physically speaking, with the angular motion, with the angular velocity of the black hole itself. Before you reach that point, you have, you know, a small range of angular velocities over which you can move, But as you get closer and closer to the black hole, that range has become very narrow, and eventually there's only one possibility. And this, if you work this out, again, follows from the detailed work that this is equal to a divided by r plus squared plus a squared, if I'm not mistaken. So anyway, so here we have a limiting place we had the first limiting place where we cannot maintain static observers. We have this other limiting place where we cannot maintain stationary observers. And then perhaps we can ask the question again, you know, we know that this is not the event horizon. We can ask the question now, is this the event horizon? And here we need to, we need to satisfy two conditions. We know, because that's the essence of the argument here, we know that this vector is going to be null at that place over here, because, you know, the vector will be time-like, provided that omega is between the two values, but when everything collapses together, the vector will turn out to be null. There's really no other choice. So the vector is null when omega is either equal to omega minus or omega plus, but now everything becomes equal. So the vector on the right-hand side will become null at that position. So we have one condition satisfied. We have the condition that this vector over here is going to be null at that place. And then we need to verify also that this null vector is hypersurface orthogonal. The answer was no there. The answer turns out to be yes here. So at r plus, the vector that we get, and here I'll give it an official name, I'll call it C. C is T alpha plus omega H phi alpha. We have that this vector is null. And also, we can verify that that this vector is hypersurface orthogonal. And that's the condition we were missing before, and that's the condition that we need to be able to conclude that this now defines the event horizon, because what do we have now? We have now hypersurface, to which this vector is both normal and tangent. We have now hypersurface because we have this condition satisfied. This vector will be tangent to the null generators of the event horizon, and the event horizon, because of my, initial condition that our observers, are stationary observers, the null surface that I'm talking about here is a stationary null surface. All of those properties essentially allow us to conclude that here we're dealing with the horizon of the black hole. The generators of the event horizon have angular momentum. They co-rotate with the black hole, of course. That's what it means for the black hole to rotate. So they wrap around the event horizon. They move along the phi direction as they move forward in time. In the old days, there was a useful analogy that could be drawn here. In the old days, you would go to the barbershop, and the barbershop would be advertised by a pole that had a red strip that would rotate like this. I guess I haven't seen those for years, but I'm old enough to remember them. You probably remember them too, right? So there was this barber pole, and the behavior of the generators of the event horizon is precisely that. I mean, they move forward in time, and they wrap around the event horizon as they do so. All right. Any questions?
Okay, so the main message here is
that, we have to be a little bit more careful at locating the event horizons than we were before because of the rotational effects. But this argument over here tells us that, the limit to the stationary observers is something that can be associated with the event horizon for the two properties that we have here, that we have null vector, which is a combination of Killing vectors. This vector also will be a Killing vector because a linear superposition with a constant coefficient, a linear combination of two Killing vectors is going to be a Killing vector. That Killing vector is null at that place R plus. It is hypersurface orthogonal, so we are dealing with a null hypersurface we are dealing with a hypersurface that's going to be generated by a bunch of null 2D6 to which this vector is tangent. The hypersurface is stationary. All of those properties tell us that that this is a very good candidate for an event horizon. And this, of course, well, is going to be confirmed by a global analysis where you look at, you know, rays that can make it to infinity, you know, the place that limits the ability to send signals to infinity and all of that stuff. It all pans out, it all confirms this argument. So that's where the event horizon is. There's another place where delta goes to zero at r minus, and that defines an inner horizon, which is another place where you find that this combination or a similar combination of Killing vectors become null. This is another place where you have the null vector becoming hypersurface orthogonal. So this defines a horizon very much like the inner horizon of the Reisner-Nordström black hole. And you can imagine here doing the same sort of procedure where you try to find a good coordinate system that allows you to go from the outside to the inside of the outer horizon, and then again from the inside, from each side, from one side to the other side of the inner horizon. So all of that can be done more or less along the same lines as what we did for Reisner-Nordström, except that it's a little bit harder because the metrics are a little bit more complicated, and we have to account for the theta dependence and all of that stuff. But it can all be done, and the internal structure of the black hole can be worked out. And it looks an awful lot, like I said before, like the internal structure of the Reisner-Nordström black hole. For example, the singularity at rho equals zero, the thing that I talked about before, turns out to be a time-like place, and like in Reisner-Nordström, and that's a place that can be avoided. As well as, you know, as it could be for Reisner-Nordström. But like Reisner-Nordström, everything that I say about what's happening inside the inner horizon is largely irrelevant because of the same stability that we talked about. The details of the parametric deep inside the black hole are really not applicable to a real black hole that would form by gravitational collapse because of all the perturbations that would spoil the validity of the solution inside the black hole. Outside, it's perfectly fine. We have a good uniqueness theorem that applies outside the black hole. It doesn't apply inside in the same way. So all of those details about the internal structure of the curved black hole are just as fictitious as what we discussed for the Reisner-Nordström black hole. One thing that's sort of important, sort of interesting, is the fact that, well, we know that the metric goes singular, you know, that we have true curvature singularity, one rho squared is equal to zero. But as you see here, rho squared is the sum of two squared things. So in order to make rho squared equal to zero, you have to make sure that each component here, each term, goes to zero separately. R has to go to zero, but the cosine of the angle also has to go to zero, which means that you only have a singularity if you're in the equatorial plane of the black hole, if the cosine of the angle is zero. And that's an interesting aspect about, you know, the exact extended curve metric, is the fact that the singularity is not only something that you can avoid by avoiding going to r equals zero, but even if you do go to r equals zero, if the cosine of the angle is not zero, you can actually avoid it too. You can hit r equals zero, but not hit the singularity if you're away from the equatorial plane. And that's a puzzling feature that took some time to get understood. And keep in mind, it's all fictitious anyway. But the resolution of this was to realize that, well, you have to understand the nature of the singularity by looking at, you know, a coordinate system near it. But what people discovered was the fact that, well, the r equals zero, the rho equals zero singularity is not like Reisner-Nordström that corresponds to a place where the volume is zero. It's not a place of zero volume. In fact, what you find is that the singularity of the curve metric is shaped as a ring. It's a ring singularity. It's singular on the ring, but you can go through the ring without encountering anything strange. And in this coordinate system, going through the ring, you know, you hit the singularity if you hit the ring. If you go through the ring, it turns out that you're going through a place called r equals zero in this coordinate system. And what you find as you look at the behavior of geodesics that go through the ring is that, well, they have access to a region of space-time where r is negative. well, what does it mean? Not all that much, but what's possible to do is not only access, you know, go through black hole tunnels and go through the usual story that we have for Reisner and Nordstrom. You can also go through the ring and end up in another universe where R is everywhere negative. And that's pretty funny, because if you look at this metric and you ask what happens if R goes negative, well, you find that not an awful lot happens, because a lot of the terms in the metric involve only R squared, right? You have R squared here, you have R squared in rho, you have R squared in delta, but you have occasionally some terms that involve the product of M times R. And formally speaking, if you let R go to take negative values, it's equivalent to, you know, leaving R alone, but making M change sign. And if you look at the metric, everywhere that you see an R, which is not squared, you see a factor of M in front of it. And changing the sign of R in the metric is entirely equivalent to changing the sign of M. So what seems to be happening here as observers go through the ring is that they emerge into some other universe, and they would look at what they left behind, and what, you know, they left behind would look like a negative mass object, which is not a black hole, because a negative mass object is not a black hole. It turns out to be a naked singularity. So the interior of the Kerr black hole is even weirder than what we encountered before in the case of Reisner Nordstrom, because of that ring-type singularity. And you know, you can read about those details in some other books, and a little bit about that in my book. But so it's a stranger place. It gets even worse than that, because you can find also regions in the deep interior of the Kerr black hole where you have post-time-like curves. So all of those properties were worked out and got people excited for a while until they realized that, well, all of that was entirely fictitious and should not be expected to be found inside a real physical rotating black hole because of the same type of instability that we talked about last time. So all of those exotic properties are really an artifact of the exact solution, and the exact solution just doesn't apply deep inside the black hole. It applies outside the black hole, as I said, but not deep inside. Okay, so there are lots more that I can say about the Kerr black hole, but I think the main aspects of this are, you know, are there, have been mentioned. So the one major difference between the Kerr black hole and the other types is the fact that it has rotation, that it does produce a dragging of inertial frame around itself, that this dragging of inertial frame gets rather extreme as you get close to the black hole. You lose the ability of maintaining a static observer if you get too close. And if you get even closer than that, you lose the ability of maintaining a stationary observer. And that's the sign that you've created an event horizon. And just to the cover of my book sort of shows this. In this coordinate system that I'm using here, the event horizon is a spherical surface because R is constant on that surface. So it's a surface of constant R. The static limit agrees with the event horizon when the cosine of the angle is 1 or minus 1. So it agrees at north and south poles, but it's going to be larger than that at other values of the angle. So the behavior of the static limit is something like this. So it starts over here at the pole, and then it's a little bit larger than the event horizon off from the pole. So we have a structure like this. This is the static limit. This is the event horizon. And inside of that, you have the inner horizon. In the book, I sort of produced that in a three-dimensional picture. It looks kind of nice. False coloring and all of that stuff. So outside here, you can have stationary, you can have static observers, but not here. Here, you can have stationary observers, but not, of course, inside the event horizon. The region over here is called the ergosphere, and that's an interesting place. That's a place where you can actually, I won't talk about this here, but you can actually generate the Penrose process where particles can pair, you know, you can have a particle coming in and create, you know, a pair of particles. You know, you can have little processes that essentially allow you to tap the rotational energy of the black hole, so that what comes out of the process is a particle with higher energy than the particle that came in, and the extra energy has been absorbed by the black hole, and, you know, well, I said wrong. So you can have a particle coming in with some energy. There's a decay process over here that will actually create a particle with negative energy as seen from infinity, but positive energy as seen from here, and you'll get a particle coming out that has more energy than the particle that you injected in at the price of slowing down the black hole a little bit. So you can tap the rotational energy of the black hole and extract that energy by a process such as the one that Penrose invented, or astrophysically speaking, you can do things like that with accretion disks or with wave-type phenomena. That's the phenomenon of super radiance of black holes. You can send a wave, and the reflected wave will come out with higher energy than the incoming wave. That's the wave-like phenomenon that's associated with the Penrose process called super radiance. So certainly the rotation aspects of the black hole turn out to have rather dramatic and interesting consequences. But because of time constraints, I think I'll stop here. And what I want to do now is to go into a more general discussion of black holes and try to really derive some results that do not require a detailed knowledge of the Kerr metric, and in fact allow me to consider situations where the outside is not necessarily vacuum. We could be dealing with a black hole that's surrounded by accretion disks or other bodies and things like that, so a more general situation than the one that's covered by the Kerr metric. So any questions before I move into that? Okay, so let me do that. Okay, so when I started talking about the Schwarzschild black hole, I introduced a fairly precise definition of what the event horizon is in terms of, you know, the boundary of the place from which you can all of your set signals to infinity. And that definition essentially was robust. That definition didn't worry about, you know, details of any metric. And, and that's the way the black holes are defined in complete generality. You don't care about any symmetries in the space-time. You just care whether or not you have an event horizon, and an event horizon is always going to be a causal boundary beyond which you cannot send signals out to infinity. And, you know, I gave you a little bit of a formal description of all this. So, in complete generality, you have a black hole region in your space-time if you have an event horizon, and an event horizon is defined to be a causal boundary, and that causal boundary has to be defined by a Dahlhausen surface. You could not have a causal boundary in a space-time that would not be a null hypersurface. It has to be a null hypersurface to really be a boundary beyond which you can no longer send signals out to infinity. So the event horizon is defined as causal boundary. And a causal boundary is defined, well, it has to be, you know, a null hypersurface. And it has to be a hypersurface which is smooth enough to guarantee that nothing will ever leak out from the inside. And that's a rather important technical aspect of the true definition of an event horizon. That is the guaranteed smoothness of the null hypersurface over all times. So the causal boundary has to be defined forever, right? I mean, nothing is allowed to escape the black hole, not just now, but also at any time later, including the far future. So what we need to have is a boundary that will be preserved for all times, and that means that our null hypersurface cannot be defined as a segment of a null hypersurface. It has to be a full hypersurface that will be defined forever into the future. And that's an important aspect. So it's a null hypersurface. A null hypersurface is going to be generated by null GV6. And the technical aspect that I'm driving at here is the fact that those null geodesics cannot have a future endpoint. They have to be expandable forever in the future. So null geodesics without endpoints. And another way of saying this is that the congruence of null geodesics that generates the event horizon has to be a smooth congruence, and it cannot have future caustics. And while we talked about caustics a while ago, a caustic is a place where two or more members of the congruence would cross. If that happens, you have a singularity of the congruence. If that happens, you have future endpoints to the null geodesics of the congruence. And if that happens, you cannot guarantee that the continuation of the congruence beyond the caustic will be smooth enough to guarantee that no light ray will ever escape from the event horizon. Just a few more things, and I'll come to your question. So the idea is something like this. You have null hypersurface, which is your candidate for an event horizon. You have a bunch of generators on it, and what you need to have for all times toward the future is a situation where the congruence of null generators never develop into a singular point that is a caustic, a point where generators would end at the common point. So you can have a situation like this, and that's good, that's a good representation of what I'm talking about. What you cannot have is a situation where, for example, you have two generators that cross over here. If they were to cross like this into a caustic, the problem would be that you would lose control over the behavior of the congruence. And you would not be able to guarantee that those generators, maybe those two, but perhaps others, they would not be guaranteed to stay within the null hypersurface. As soon as you form a caustic, there's the possibility of something could emerge from the caustic and get to infinity. So the very idea that you have a causal boundary, a smooth hypersurface beyond which you cannot send signals, requires a really strong statement about the fact that the behavior of the generators has to be perfectly smooth, because as soon as you form a caustic, you lose the ability of guaranteeing that all your generators will stay to, will continue to define the hypersurface. As soon as you form a caustic, you cannot guarantee that the congruence will continue to generate a hypersurface. And what that means is that, well, there's a chance, there's a possibility for another generator that, that another light ray that might come in from the inside would encounter that caustic and would leak out to the outside. So you need that in order to really define properly what an event horizon is. And that has important consequences, but it's also a tool. The fact that we must have this, not that, it turns out to be a rather powerful way of proving theorems, and I'll show some examples of that later on. You had a question? Okay. Notice that I'm talking about future caustics. I'm not talking about past caustics, because in fact, it would be too much to ask also that this behavior should be, that this smoothness behavior should be extendable not only to the future, but also to the past. And we already know that this would be too much, and here's an example. Remember that that space-time diagram that I drew before represents the formation of a black hole. So we have a collapsing star, we have the formation of a singularity, and then we have this light ray that's emitted from the center at just the right time, so that by the time it has crossed all of the collapsing matter, it has been focused just enough to be stationary in the future. Those are the generators of the event horizon. And as I wrap this around, we have a full confluence of generators to the event horizon. So what I want to be able to guarantee is that, this generator will not have an endpoint that would then, produce the chance that something could leak out from the event horizon and reach infinity. So I want to rule this out. But here's a caustic that I have that I cannot rule out because it's there, right? We have, the event horizon started out at some finite time. It was created at some time. And the creation of the event horizon is a place where all of the light rays that generate the event horizon all start together. That's certainly a singularity of the confluence. But it's there for a good physical reason. We have to start, the event horizon has to be created at some finite time. And the creation point of an event horizon tends to be a caustic. So this is a past caustic. This is a past endpoint of the confluence. And what we have prior to that point are light rays that were converging toward the center to be re-emitted from the center as they converge in to form the event horizon. So here we have past endpoint. We have continuation of those caustics, but because of those light rays toward the past. But because we have a caustic here, well, essentially we have an endpoint to where the event horizon, is. So we can have past endpoints because the event horizon, was created in the past. We cannot have future endpoints because we don't want the event horizon to be destroyed in the future. If it were destroyed in the future, or even perturbed a little bit like this, we could not guarantee the causal boundary, between the black region and future infinity. So caustics are a really common feature of event horizons. And for example, there's this famous trouser diagram that represents the merger of two black holes. For example, suppose that you have one black hole that moves to the right and another black hole that moves to the left, and they happen to merge into one another. What will happen is that the two horizons will join together and they will form a larger horizon. And the two black holes will emerge to form a much larger black hole. So we can have a situation like this. So each black hole might have been formed, in the past. So there would be starting points in the past to each one of those two separate horizons. But at the merger point, what we have at the cross over here, we do have other past caustics to the event horizon. What happens at the merger point is that, generators of the first horizon can smoothly go into the larger horizon, and generators like that can just continue to go, so they were there on the initial horizons and they just merge, smoothly as the larger horizon gets formed. So that's one possible behavior, but another possible behavior is that, in fact, you allow new light rays, new generators to enter the larger horizon through the crotch. They might have originated from over here, and then they just happened to, meet that point at the exact time where the event horizons were merging. And at that past caustic, they are allowed to enter and join together with the other generators of the larger horizon. So you can have a number of, additional light rays that join eventually, the event horizon from a new creation point to the inner part of the event horizon. So that's allowed, of course. You're allowed to new generators are allowed to enter the event horizon from the past. What is never allowed is for, generators to stop in the future and, to have exit points, or future caustics in the future of the creation point. So that's a common situation. What we want to guarantee and what we want to rule out are future endpoints to the generators. Those generators have to, so once they've entered the event horizon, they cannot meet again, they cannot form caustics anywhere in the future.
Having ever seen any of this stuff before, but you'd learned all about the planetary recurrence theorem and you'd learned all about the fact that the laws of physics don't pick out the direction of time.
Right.
Wouldn't you expect to leave open the possibility of caustic? I mean, why are you making a fundamental distinction between the past and the future?
Somehow I knew this question. It's an old question, and it's a common question, and in fact, it's a very important one, because here, explicitly, you're breaking time-traversal invariance. And it might appear surprising, because general relativity, like the rest of the laws of physics, are time-traversal invariant. Here, you're introducing notions that clearly, break this. But that's done immediately as you start talking about event horizons. Because what you care about, the way that you define an event horizon is about signals that go to future known infinity. So you're talking about, you're talking about light rays that will or will not reach future known infinity, and you say explicitly that you're dealing only with future known infinity. So the point is that, yes, general relativity is time reversal invariant. The definition of what a black hole is and the definition of what an event horizon is explicitly breaks time reversal invariance, because you insist that you want to deal with future events, not past events.
Yeah.
you have the possibility of defining time diverse notions of all this, and now start talking about what can reach from the past, the inside of your, you know, of your object, and that's when a black hole becomes a white hole. That's when an event horizon becomes an anti horizon, or whatever you want to call it. And in this time diverse picture, so in this picture, so the way that you define an event horizon,
you have a theorem, in fact, follows from those ideas that says that a black hole can never bifurcate. Because a bifurcation of a black hole into two smaller black holes would be a time reverse picture. It would be the time reversal of this picture, where you would have caustic in the future of the event horizon, well, you know, along the future of the event horizon. That cannot happen, and it's a theorem just because, well, you've ruled this out essentially in your definitions of what a black hole is supposed to be and what an event horizon is supposed to be. You can do the time reversal of that and talk about white holes, and here you would rule out merging black holes, but you would allow white holes bifurcations. And if you really believe the time reversal invariance in physics, you might say, well, okay, now that I know that black holes might exist, I should make an equal statement about white holes existing by time reversal invariance. And I think people have played with those kind of ideas, but it doesn't seem to be all useful, in fact, to insist in the existence of the time diverse picture.
I mean, I just was going to say, if it's a question of definition, that that's what you mean by, or that's what you mean by an event horizon, then it seems to me that everything that we know about physics, unless we have some principled way of understanding, for example, why general relativity violates the Poincaré return scale. Maybe because it's not a conservative system, I don't know. Maybe because there isn't a conservation principle, something like that. Mm-hmm. Then I would say that the correct position to take would be that these are not definitions that will turn out to be physically useful. They're implausible from the beginning.
I could take that point of view, but I think it would be like taking the point of view that, well, time reversal invariance also tells me that entropy can increase toward the future as opposed to, decrease toward the future as opposed to increase toward the future. And even though, yes, that's allowed by microscopic dynamics, it doesn't seem to happen in the future, in real, in real physical systems. And therefore, you sort of, you build an intuition about the world where temperature practice has to be taken all that, you know, to the logical extreme. Because there are other factors that tell you that it does increase. And that, you know, the future, you know, that the definition of black hole could be more useful for physics than the white hole type definition. But I agree with you that this is added ingredients that don't follow, you know, logically from time reversal environments. I mean, it's still a puzzle to a lot of people to be why it does increase as opposed to decrease when involved in physics allow both. Presumably the resolution to that has to do with, you know, specifying low entropy conditions and preparing the universe for a low entropy state. So it's funny that you have to resort to those types of conditional arguments. Here, I think we have a similar situation. So we believe that this is useful for physics, therefore we are happy to break time diverse environments, but somebody else would be very unhappy about this, in fact, to contest it and expect to take the consequences of the more symmetric picture. And I think a debate like this has happened in the 70s when those, you know, definitions were first introduced, and people realized that, you know, there was a tension between time diverse environments. And I think there was a time where it was popular to think that white holes could exist, but as a time reversal.
They're just like this. If these are bad, then the white holes are just. So the issue is, why is there either one or the other not?
Right.
You see the point?
Yes.
Anyways.
All I can say is that this turned out to be useful, and I'm not sure what the consequence of the avoidance of all this would have been.
Okay. Yeah.
Other questions? Okay. So that's something that could be said. So this is
really a general feature of black holes. So the very definition of what a black hole is, what an event horizon is, really introduces those ideas about, you know, having a null hypersurface as a causal boundary, having generators on that null hypersurface, having past creation points where you have a singularity of the congruence in the past, but you rule out completely the possibility of having future endpoints, because that would destroy, you know, the guarantee that you have a true causal boundary. If you had a future endpoint, you could not guarantee that things could not leak out of the event horizon and therefore spoil the definition. So that's something I'll come back to, but the main point here is that this is something I could say without making reference to any metric, and this is, you know, one of the most general and most fundamental property of what a black hole is. So that was, you know, being completely general. So now let me go from completely general to something which is a bit more restrictive. And I'll assume that my black hole, whatever it is going to be a stationary black hole. So here I'm assuming that the spacetime outside the black hole is stationary in the sense of being time independent, and also that the metric itself is time reversal. So that would be static. I'm only demanding that that the metric outside the black hole be time independent, and I'm saying that there must be a killing vector in my spacetime. So here I'm not demanding time reversal invariance. That's not necessary. If I have that, it turns out that I have a lot more also. So what Hawking was able to say in I think it was in 72. Was the fact that if you assume the existence of a time-like killing vector in the exterior of the black hole, if you assume that your black hole is stationary, and you don't need to assume anything more than that, you don't need to assume the validity of the Kerr metric, you don't need to assume the vacuum exterior, here you can be dealing with a black hole that is perturbed by external matter. This is a, you know, there could be an accretion disk around the black hole. Well, I don't want flow of matter, but there could be some structures, you know, around the black hole that would respect this, the stationarity of the space-time. But the point is that this does not have to be a Kerr black hole. And what Hawking was able to prove just by making this assumption is that, well, if you have a stationary black hole, you have two choices. Either it's going to be static, which means that it will be, on top of being stationary, it will also be time reversal invariant, or it has to be actually symmetric. So stationarity buys you either a static spacetime, or it buys you active symmetry. So it has to be static or actually symmetric. And the physical interpretation of this will be that if you have a stationary black hole, either it's not rotating, or if it's rotating, then it's actually symmetric. If it's axially symmetric, if it's stationary and axially symmetric, then you have two killing vectors. So you have the existence of two killing vectors, the stationary killing vector and the axially symmetric killing vector. So in the rotating case, we have the existence of those two killing vectors, and another result that Hawking was able to establish is the fact that the combination that I've talked about before, but here a combination that that is more general. So what Hawking was able to show is that there's a combination of killing vectors involving some coefficient that, you know, at the time being doesn't have a physical interpretation. There's a combination of killing vectors which happens to be null on the event horizon. So there's a linear combination of killing vectors, the killing vectors that you get if the spacetime is rotating, and that combination is null on the event horizon. And it's not only null, but it's also hypersurface orthogonal, so that you do have an event horizon and event horizon that's going to be generated by knowledge UD6 to which C is tangent. So the event horizon is generated by knowledge UD6 to which C is tangent. And the physical meaning of the omega h parameter is simply that, well, this is going to be the angular velocity of the generators as, you know, as measured in terms of external time. So omega h is, by definition, the angular velocity of the generators. And this is what you call the angular velocity of the black hole. So this is something we've seen before for the Kerr metric. The point, as always here, is that this is something that can be established, as Hawking did, on the basis of the stationarity assumption and nothing else. And you don't need a detailed metric to obtain this result. This is something that is more robust than you know, that what follows as a consequence of the Kerr metric. Yep.
So what Hawking had to let's see, I read the paper a long time ago. So I think you do so you assume that the excitation is space-time with an event horizon. And then while you don't know well, I mean you don't know where it is, but you know it exists. And what Hawking proved is that well that this vector is null on the event horizon. I'm not sure exactly how I don't remember if I proved this.
In that case, just without the Bayesian vector?
Right. So the static case then becomes a special case of the stationary case where you lose the rotation parameter. And what you find is that the time-like filling vector now is where, when it goes null, is where the event horizon is.
Can I just get clear about this?
Yep.
He's assuming the existence of an event horizon, which has these properties that you've mentioned before, the absence of Q-chip constants.
That's correct.
Now,
well, since here I can only that, so here the assumption that the space-time is stationary pretty much guarantees that, you know, if you have smoothness of the event horizon in a stationary space-time, then the absence of constants is guaranteed.
Because I'm just trying to say, I mean, this in a sense is stronger than the current solution. Because the Kerr solution is just a solution of Einstein's field equations.
With the assumed symmetry.
With the assumed symmetry.
Right. So you need to build in the symmetry. So you get the symmetry if you assume that the outside is, so you get the uniqueness theorem, and therefore the symmetry as a result of the Einstein field equations, provided that the outside is vacuum.
But
what I want to buy here is the freedom of putting something on the outside that will preserve the stationarity of the space-time, but will make the solution, the black hole metric, not the Kerr metric. It's not going to be the Kerr metric if there's something outside the Kerr black hole.
But does the Kerr metric require, in and of itself, the absence of caustics on the end of the event horizon?
No, so that's the result. So once you have the Kerr metric, then you can look at the behavior of the generators of the event horizon.
Right.
And the kinetic symmetry just guarantees that the event horizon, that the generators will be forever extendable, and you don't run into problems.
Okay.
All right. So so the point is that well we get something that we recognize the Kerr solution, but we have this with more generality than the Kerr solution. Okay. Well, it turns out that this is pretty rich of consequences, so I want to start working through that a little bit.
So C has, well, two main properties. First of all, it's a null vector field on the event horizon. And also, because it's the linear combination of two killing vectors, it is itself a killing vector. So let me work through some of the consequences of that. And again, you'll recognize some of those features from what we talked about before. So let me define a scalar quantity that I'll call phi. For some reason, I called it phi squared instead of phi. So let me define this to be the length of the killing vector. And what that allows me to do is to say that the event horizon has a defining equation that says that phi squared is equal to zero. So that's one way to locate the event horizon in the space-time. And what do I want to do with that? We can prove okay, I'll just prove a result that I'll need. Do I need this? Okay, no, sorry. Okay. So, what I want to do with this is to show that this vector actually satisfies the Judy's equation on the event horizon. And what I'll do is to use this as the defining equation. So let me remove the square here. I don't need it. So what I want to prove is that, well, having defined the event horizon as this, I can construct a normal vector by taking a gradient of this. The normal vector will have to be at once normal and tangent to the event horizon. So the normal vector has to point in the direction of xi if xi is, tangent to the event horizon. And that will prove that, what we'll find from that is that xi has to satisfy the Judy's equation. So the normal to the event horizon can be defined to be, the gradient of the function phi. And if I work this out, let's see, do I want the minus sign here? Doesn't matter. So what I'm doing here is to calculate, so I take this quantity over here and I differentiate with respect to alpha. And I'll get twice the same term. So I get minus 2. I get the metric, so I can raise the index here. And I get, so I think I'll do it like that. I get one of the vectors differentiated. Because this is a killing vector, this quantity here is anti-symmetric in the two indices. And I can rewrite this as twice plus twice xi. And what I have here on the right-hand side is the acceleration associated with the killing vector. All right. While the rest of the calculation is simply a statement that the normal to the event horizon has to be in the direction of the killing vector. Because, the normal vector, given that we're dealing with a null hypersurface, the normal vector has to be at once, both normal and tangent. And it has to be, it has to point in the direction of the killing vector. So what that gives us then so the normal vector has to be proportional to xi itself. And therefore, I have equality between the acceleration and the vector itself up to a proportionality factor. So instead of saying this with proportionality constant, I could say that what I have here is some factor multiplying C, I'll call it kappa. And the reason why I call it kappa is because, well, if I equate those two things, I find that, well, the acceleration of the Killing vector is proportional to the Killing vector itself. And that's the generalized form of the Judy's equation. And that just confirms that if C, so if C is null on the event horizon, it has to be, you know, it has to be true that the normal to the event horizon is going to be the direction of C. And that guarantees that C has to satisfy the Judy's equation. So that's the usual story about null hypersurfaces being defined, being generated by null geodesics. And what we confirmed here is something that we knew for a long time. I just wanted to reproduce the argument. We have the statement that C is tangent to the null generators of the event horizon. And what we find is that, there's a non-zero right-hand side, so it's the generalized form of the Judy's equation. And kappa is what we would formally define as the surface gravity of the black hole. It's defined fundamentally as that parameter on the right-hand side of the Judy's equation that prevents the that tells us that, well, yes, we do have a bunch of so we do have geodesics. C is tangent to those geodesics, but C does not come with an affine parameterization. The parameterization of the geodesics is not affine. Okay. So anyway, so the point of all this is that once you say, let's deal with stationary black holes, you have all the stuff that came from Hawking. And in particular, you have an event horizon, which is also the Killing horizon. You have the Killing vector on the horizon. The generator, the vector tangent to the null generators is something which involves both the time-like Killing vector and the rotational Killing vector. And all the stuff that we knew from the Kerr solution, including the fact that we have this Judy's equation, the fact that the generators are null geodesics, all of that can be sort of reproduced, again, without the details of the Kerr metric, simply on the assumption and the results that we have there, the assumption of stationary space-time and the assumption of, the assumption of stationary space-time and then the results from Hawking that say that that space-time has to be stationary and axially symmetric if it's rotating. Okay. I'll come back to that later. The surface gravity turns out to be a rather important characterization of black hole. For a Kerr black hole, I should have said that before because that turns out to be important. For a Kerr black hole, kappa is something that can be calculated. Essentially, you just, you know, do this calculation for the Kerr metric and then see what kappa turns out to be. And let's see, I have an expression for this somewhere. Kappa turns out to be equal to m squared minus a squared under square root divided by r plus squared plus a squared. So there are two interesting things about this. First of all, kappa goes to zero if the black hole becomes extremal. So that's something that that also happens for Ryson and Nordstrom. The surface gravity of a Ryson and Nordstrom black hole goes to zero in the extremal case, and you know, in the homework assignment that you're working on these days, you have an example of that. So if we've saturated the bound between the angular momentum parameter and the mass, you find that the surface gravity of the black hole goes to zero. So that's one interesting feature. The really interesting aspect of this, which is really a big deal, is the fact that kappa, the surface gravity of the black hole, is independent of the angle theta on the event horizon. So if you ask all sorts of things, for example, if you look at the induced geometry on the event horizon of the black hole, you look at the intrinsic 2 geometry of the black hole event horizon, you find that certainly the geometry of the horizon is not spherically symmetric. You know, though the event horizon is, you know, flattened at the pole, it's extended at the equator, and that's, you know, a natural expectation that you would get because of the rotation of the black hole. So the induced geometry of the event horizon is not spherically symmetric. The geometry does depend on the angle theta. Well, the surface gravity is an important characterization of that geometry, and somehow the theta dependence that you might have expected should be there. You might have expected the surface gravity to be, you know, to be weaker at the equator because the equator is a little bit larger in, you know, in geometric terms, in area terms, you know. The event horizon is bulging at the equator. You might have expected the surface gravity to be smaller there. You might have expected the surface gravity to be larger at the poles because, you know, the poles are a little bit squashed as a result of the rotation. Yet the result is that
while the surface gravity is uniform across the event horizon, it knows nothing of that distortion created by the rotation of the black hole. And that turns out to be a rather remarkable feature because it doesn't match physical expectations, you know, that we would have about the surface gravity of any body. And essentially what I'll do this afternoon is to show that, well, in fact, that's something that's not only true for Kerr, but it's true also for all stationary black holes, which are not Kerr, the statement that the surface gravity is uniform across the entire event horizon is something that can be established without, you know, relying on the Kerr metric that follows simply from this whole set of assumptions.
And that result is remarkable. It's actually very interesting. And it's known as the zero flaw of black hole mechanics. And
what I'll do mostly this afternoon is to you know, talk about those laws. I'll sketch some of their derivations, and we'll see that this is a property that's not only true for Kerr, but true for all of those stationary yet symmetric black holes. That kappa doesn't depend on time is not surprising. That kappa doesn't depend on phi is not surprising. That kappa doesn't depend on the polar angle is something that is a bit more surprising. Before lunch, I'd like to do something, just one more thing, and that doesn't take too much time.
So here we have non-affine parameterization of the null generators of the event horizon. So what I like to do is to call the non-affine parameter the one that's inherited from the normalization of the Killing vector. I'll call it V. I like to call it V. And it's not the same V that we encountered in the case of, you know, Schwarzschild and Reisner and Nordstrom, but it's a coordinate like V that is regular on the event horizon. It's a measure of time that is regular on the event horizon, and it's just a parameter that we can use to describe the behavior of the generators. So what I'll say is that, well, displacement along generators is described by an equation that says that, well, the displacement in the coordinates is going to be in the direction of the tangent vector, and the increment in the parameter is going to be dv. So dv is going to be my non-affine parameter, knowing that kappa is constant along the generators, which is a property I'll derive later. You could, you know, do the usual conversion between the non-affine parameter and an affine parameter, but it turns out that we won't have any real need for the affine parameter along the null generator, so I'll be dealing with V as the parameter along the generators. So the one thing I wanted to do before lunch is to write down Reich-Chaudhury's equation, which is an important equation that governs the behavior of those generators, and we can learn quite a few things, a few important things, by just writing it down. So when we talked about the Bray Chiodura equation before, you know, I talked about the time I case, and then I talked about the null case. When I was talking about the null case, for simplicity, I was using an affine parameterization for my congruence. But in one of your homework assignments, you were asked to go through the same story, but allowing for a non-affine parameterization of the GD thing. So the version of Bray Chiodura's equation that I need here is the one that does have non-affine parameterization, because, you know, I'm choosing V as my parameter. So what the equation tells us is that, well, the rate at which the congruence is expanding, theta, well, will have time derivative that's going to be given by something involving the surface gravity, because it's the thing that appears on the right-hand side of the generalized 2D equation, minus half theta squared minus the square of the shear tensor. There's no rotation tensor here because we're talking about the congruence of 2d6, which is hypersurface orthogonal. And there's a term that comes from the Ricci tensor, which is here converted into the energy momentum tensor by using the field equations. So that's Bray Chiodura. But this is an equation that simplifies because I'm dealing with a stationary horizon. So my spacetime is stationary. And as a consequence, the horizon is not something that's expected to expand nor contract in time. We're dealing with a horizon which is stationary. And, you know, the mathematical statement of this is to say that, well, if we have a stationary horizon, it's got to be true that the expansion of the null generator is zero, and it's got to be true that, well, it stays zero at all times, which means that its time derivative also is zero, or, you know, its V derivative. So if we're dealing with a stationary horizon, we get rid of this, we get rid of that, we get rid of this, and we find that what's left over must be equal to zero. Well, if I have a sum of two positive things, well, let me say that again. If I have a sum of two non-negative things that happens to be zero, it's got to be true that each individual term is zero all by itself, right? So, for example, the shear tensor is something which is a purely spatial tensor. The square of the shear tensor can be zero, or it can be positive, but it can't be negative. So we know that this has to be non-negative, just by its very definition. And we know that this will be non-negative if we impose the appropriate energy condition, which in this case is the null energy condition. If I have two non-negative things being added to be zero, they have to be zero individually. And the consequence is that if I have the null energy condition, so we'll impose that. If I have the null energy condition, the condition that I have stationary horizon translates into a statement that the null generators cannot have shear tensor. The shear of the generators has to be zero. And we also have the statement that on the event horizon, if we have a distribution of matter across the event horizon, it has to be such that the null-null component of the energy momentum tensor vanish. So it's possible for a stationary black hole to live in a distribution of matter. The only requirement is that there cannot be a flux of matter across the event horizon. We can have matter in the form, for example, of an electromagnetic field. We've seen that. The electromagnetic field tensor will satisfy this property. So there can be electrostatic density, you know, inside and outside the black hole. That's not ruled out. That's fine. What we cannot have is a flow of matter. This is the component of the energy momentum tensor that would describe flow of matter across the event horizon. We don't have that. If we have a stationary horizon, we cannot have the flow of matter across the event horizon. If we had the flow of matter across the event horizon, the generators would have to expand so that the focusing exerted by the default matter would stop by the time that the process is over. So anyway, so that's, you know, all of those consequences come very nicely as a consequence of this assumption over there. And what I'll do this afternoon is to well, incorporate a lot of that into a discussion of the laws of black hole mechanics, the four laws of black hole mechanics, starting at 0, 1, 2, 3, and we'll see that we can make some very clean statements about the behavior of black holes without having to rely on the detail, without having to rely on the details of the Kerr metric, which to me is nice because you have, you know, a more general set of situations. And also, while it turns out those proofs tend to be pretty, whereas if you work them out in terms of, you know, by playing around with the Kerr metric, well, there's a lot of misc algebra that follows. And you can avoid a lot of that by doing it in a more gentle way. And I think you learn more by doing that. So this afternoon, I'll do that. And I think now it's time to break for lunch.